Hi, this is Bill Indicke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. I have a special episode for you today. This week's podcast is a Streets.mn roundtable conversation about East Lake Street, featuring Sam Newberg, one of our regular contributors. As part of his day job, Sam recently completed a study on development potential of the East Lake Corridor, which runs from Hiawatha east to the Mississippi River. Sam, Spencer Agnew, Nate Hood, and myself met up at Merlin's Rest on East Lake Street, a great pub, last week to talk about the study and all of our individual thoughts about the past and future of East Lake. Our conversation covered a lot of ground, from form-based codes to auto-oriented development to the story of the West River Commons to different potential features of the street. This is going to be the first of many Streets.mn roundtables, I hope, and I hope that you enjoy the conversation.
Spencer Agnew, and I'm here with Bill and Sam, also from the Streets.mn team, and we're here talking today about East Lake Street in Minneapolis, and kind of just a general dissatisfaction with the way it looks and what's on it. I work for the Longfellow Community Council, which is the neighborhood association in this area, and we recently were fortunate through a grant from the city of Minneapolis to hire Sam and his company Joe Urban to do a market study of the corridor and generally kind of try to identify, you know, what are the factors that are influencing what's on East Lake Street, why it looks the way it is, why there's a substantial amount of commercial retail vacancy, and try to identify some strategies to basically improve the corridor, draw in more businesses, and make it a better place to be. So I guess that's our topic for today, if that kind of explains it well. I don't know if Sam, you kind of want to kind of give a rundown about your study and what you found.
Yeah, I'll do that. I'd like to think that although the study is done and has been written and presented, that the work has only just begun. And I mean that sincerely, because I think going into it, what LCC asked me to do was look at the market and why there's vacancy. What is the problem? And I had an alternative. I had the choice between, and I don't mean to diminish what market analysts do, but I had the choice to spit out a bunch of numbers and graphs and charts and talk about the demand for retail and commercial space and strategies to attract retailers and what was wrong. But I realized right away, I think the problem goes much deeper than that. And not only is retail a complex thing to address, but it really gets to the vision for what the street should be and issues with how it has developed over time. It was originally one of the big commercial corridors in the city. It ran east-west. There was a streetcar along it. And while you could do a lot of your shopping and arrive by transit, it was also a bigger destination than that, the way 494 sort of replaced that over time. You used to be able to buy new cars on Lake Street, and over time, all those new dealerships went out to 494. Now they've moved beyond that. You can't find as many new cars on even that stretch anymore.
The Best Buy headquarters is a good example.
Best Buy headquarters, right. The Oldsmobile dealership is long gone. And you can still buy a car on Lake Street now. And that's the tension between the vision for the street to be a commercial, pedestrian-friendly street and some of the old uses that are drive-throughs and auto sales and uses like that that are low density and diminish the vitality of the street. And so it's a complex issue, and one of the problems was that the street was rebuilt just a few years ago along its entire stretch, and it was rebuilt into a more pedestrian-friendly street. The street right-of-way itself is largely unchanged, and the parking on street is mostly the same, but the sidewalks are greatly enhanced, and there's better trees that will grow into a better canopy over time, and there's benches, and the bus shelters are better, and most, if not all, of the street is under a special service district that helps maintain some of that stuff, and they, you know, pick up trash and patch concrete and do the things that need to be done. And my opinion is, when you are making a dynamic change like that and spending millions of dollars, that not having a land use or zoning or planning process for the land abutting the street is a big mistake. And I think, you know, you can't always control when the different silos of government do their job. Like, this job came along, the street had to be rebuilt, they did it, it got pushed forward, but there should have been a concerted, related effort to upzone a lot of what is along the street and envision how it should be handled. Now, you have less of a problem to the west, near the Midtown Global Market and that stretch, because there's been attention paid to that through different sources over time. And, you know, the Mercado Central at Bloomington, for example, was created out of a lot of effort from the city and nonprofits, and the Latino private market to make Bloomington and Lake a very nice area. And the Midtown Exchange itself had a ton of effort and attention paid to it, and that's a big success in most ways. And in Uptown, you just have a pretty dynamic market. People just want to be there, and while certainly there's been public resources put towards some projects, a lot of those are, that's just the private market inertia building mostly good places and good urban development. So east of Hiawatha, and starting with the Hiawatha Lake Street Light Rail Station area and going east from there, there hasn't been a huge attention to, there hasn't been enough effort made, in my opinion, to envision what the city should look like and what the corridor should be. And maybe that time is coming now after this. So, you know, the caveat is, of course, there's a Lake Street Station plan, but what has become of the development in the 10 years since? And it's there's been development, but it's been slow going, and it's difficult to get all the different parties and landowners to work together. So it's still a work in process, but the corridor needs a little attention, and frankly, the you know, Longfellow Community Council needs to make the case as to why it needs attention. And that's kind of a wild card, because when you look at the corridor, there are chain fast food drive-through restaurants, there's national chain retailers, there's upscale and downscale retailers, there's a lot of auto-oriented, a lot of surface parking. There's a lot of facades along the street that don't have windows even, much less doors, and they aren't very pedestrian-friendly. And then there's very good examples of urbanism as well in old and new buildings. So it's this hodgepodge of, and it's very hard to pin down what that vision should be anyway.
Well, one of the more interesting findings from your report was the kind of generally that there's an oversupply of retail space in the corridor compared to the spending power in the market area. You know, when you have high commercial vacancy, but there's not necessarily the spending power to, you know, fill that vacancy with retail uses, what do you do with those spaces? Do you kind of encourage conversion to other uses, such as residential? You know, what do? You just wait until, you know, hope that the spending power will increase in the area and that there will be increased demand for retail? What do you do?
Yeah, and I think it's a multifaceted question too. There are And what you're referring to, Spencer, is the market for.
I like gin as an example.
Could I get a patty whiskey meat? Thanks.
Okay, for now.
Where was I? Oh, with retail space, what I looked at was the mile radius around the corridor, and is spending for different categories of retail dollars going outside that mile or staying in the mile? And then look at it kind of from a real world perspective for a second. If you want if you're a middle to upper middle income household and you don't feel like shopping at Cub or Rainbow and you prefer Lunds, well, your dollar is being spent outside that mile. And if you shop at Lunds or Rainbow or, you know, for household, well, Trader Joe's, you can go outside too, right? But if you like Cub and Rainbow or Target for your household needs, you shop in that area. And so you go down the line of different categories. There's a pharmacy, there's Walgreens, thank you. And so there's a lot of retail needs being served. But for different categories, there was an undersupply of retail and, in many cases, an oversupply. The supply was met. There are plenty of groceries and grocery dollars being spent within that mile along Lake Street. So there probably doesn't need to be another grocery store. But when you realize, there's probably room for a high-end grocer that might be successful along Lake Street. It would draw people from a much bigger area, like Trader Joe's, for example. Yes. And
I have Trader Joe's Tourette's.
Okay. Well, yes. A lot of people do. And but that's a good example of how, on paper, you say, there's plenty of grocery dollars being spent here. You don't need any more. But really, you might. And it might be very successful if you brought a Trader Joe's in. So I think for different... And then retail is also it feeds on itself, and if you create the West End is a good example in St. Louis Park. That's a brand new retail center that's attracting dollars to that part of that corner of St. Louis Park that were never spent there before, but it's predatory. It preys on those dollars are only finite and they're coming from somewhere, and it's probably at a lot. It's probably resulting in a loss of spending somewhere else. So when, classic example, when an old shopping mall gets tired, like Brookdale, and something out in Maple Grove is brand new and shiny, people go out there instead. And that's just the way retail works. So you could create your own market for retail along Lake Street if you had enough land and the right access and traffic and, that sort of happened back when Target and Rainbow and Cub were built anyway. That was a manufacturing employment center, and now it's a big retail center, and it does well. But so you can sort of take advantage of those situations. I just don't see that changing appreciably unless those uses redeveloped into more of a lifestyle center, urban kind of place. And, it's not going to happen because Target just renovated their store, and they're not going anywhere. So it's probably realistic to look at the corridor as, there's opportunities for other retailers to come in, but there's also, when redevelopment happens, it might very well be just housing. And I think that's perfectly acceptable to think it can happen. That's reasonable.
Probably so. The last substantial redevelopment on East Lake Street was, of course, West River Commons, roughly 8 years ago now.
It's about 8 years ago, yeah.
So, on the far eastern end of the corridor, for those not familiar, East Lake Street, roughly from Hiawatha to the Mississippi River. The west end, you've got Hiawatha Avenue, light rail, then the big box node of Target, Rainbow, and Cub. On the other end, you've got the river, the West River Commons, mixed-use development, kind of higher end, higher property values, success, very few vacancies on that end. And in the middle, you've got a mix of small-scale retail, auto-oriented uses, kind of higher vacancies.
That's the thing that I always notice when I come around here. And I, other people as well. It's like, I walk down this part of Lake Street and I just think there are so many really cool old buildings that are just empty and boarded up and just lying there with a for rent sign on. You know, the list is really long.
Yeah.
And I forget how many years ago they actually did the new streetscaping, but I think it was about 7 years ago or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
But the sidewalks are gorgeous. This is a really nice part of town. The neighborhoods all around here are really great. The houses are in great shape. It's in the middle of everything. It's connected by transit pretty well, even though the 21 kind of sucks. But, you know, it's not bad. It's pretty good. And yet there's these, like, amazing old storefronts that are empty and have been empty for decades, and it's hard for me to connect those two things in my mind. So it's almost like a paradox to me, this Lake Street.
I think some of the challenges are that there are, besides at the two ends, the West River Parkway on the east and Minnehaha Avenue, Hiawatha Avenue on the west, there's no substantial north-south cross streets to have any traffic at all. Like, we're here at Merlin's Rest on 36th Ave, which I think is the highest traffic count cross street, and that's something like 3,000 cars, maybe
right. It's a pretty quiet street. It wouldn't generate a ton of retail draw just from its traffic alone.
And then East Lake itself has, you know, it's not a substantial amount of traffic as far as kind of retail corridors go. I think it's in the range of 18,000 cars a day, which compared to some of the other major commercial corridors in Minneapolis isn't that much.
Right. It's pretty high at the Hiawatha area, and as you get east of here at 36, it's pretty quiet. It's not really a... In fact, one of the faults, maybe people criticize the redesign of the street for not narrowing it to one lane of traffic in each direction and make it more of a boulevard, more pedestrian-friendly street, because really you can probably handle that at its current traffic counts. And that's a fight that maybe wasn't fought and certainly wasn't won, and might have to wait for another day.
So Sam, do you want to talk about, you know, where is the next likeliest place for, you know, substantial redevelopment to happen? You know, on the west we have the light rail station, a lot of surface parking. I think a lot of people would have hoped to see some sort of, you know, housing mixed use development happen there.
Well, my favorite spot is by the Hiawatha, by the Lake Street Station, west of Minnehaha, well, west of 26/Minnehaha, the northwest corner of that intersection. The south end of the Target parking lot, which one of the images I showed in the presentations was the Saturday before Christmas, which is supposed to be that's the day that retail malls save all their parking for. They build enough capacity so that on that day, when everyone is shopping for Christmas, their parking lot is the right size and they have enough spaces to accommodate everybody. And on that day last year, that end of the parking lot was still empty. And that says, if nothing else, that it's time to develop that site. And you could easily do so with a nice 4 or 5 story building with retail on the ground floor and plenty of surface parking behind it, because it's a huge parking lot, and you could easily lease apartments, probably market rate, but certainly affordable, above, 80 to 100 units of housing. You're right next to the light rail station. That would lease overnight, and I have no doubt in my mind that that could be a successful project if someone came along and if the landowner was willing to part ways with that section of their parking lot, which they should. So that seems like a slam dunk and a no-brainer to me. I don't know why it hasn't happened yet, and it just seems to me that the right buttons need to be pushed at City Hall. I mean, it's part of the plan for that, for the Lake Street Station area. And so beyond that, you know, there's other opportunities near that, but I think as you get to, well, there's a big lot at almost a half acre at 30th in Lake, where the McMahon's pub and coincidentally, a mixed-use building used to be, and it burned down a couple years ago. And it's been for sale since then, and it's now on its second listing agent with a different broker. And it's in the section of Lake Street that where it's hard to make a project pencil out in terms of mixed use, because you can't get really high rents. You're not right by light rail, and you're not on the east end of the corridor where you have river views and sort of quote-unquote the nicer end of the street. So, yes, a project there could easily accommodate, 50 or more units. Well, maybe that's on the high end of unit count. But, you know, you could get an affordable, like a tax credit project going there and maybe have some ground floor retail space. And as you go east along the corridor, I think the natural locations are the vacant buildings and spaces. And one of the biggest ones is east of here at 39th, the G.C. Peterson
Machinery
Building that's on the south side of Lake and takes up most of that block, but there's a couple other buildings, and that's currently being pursued by a grocer who would open a mid to upper market, kind of an old school grocery store, which I think could work really well. And based on what I've seen of the site design, based on what I've seen of his site plans, it could work, and it could be a very nice store, and there could be enough parking for it. And you know, a grocery store is going to need parking, and I'd like to think you could put it on the roof, but he's going to put it in a surface parking lot, and that's okay. And I think
that's never happened in the Twin Cities, as far as I know, right?
Oh, parking. But it should. And
I saw it in Portland once.
Yes, you've seen that. Okay, I know about that, and I think Lake Street's a perfect opportunity to try rooftop grocery store parking. You can accommodate everything on the roof, and you save the pedestrian realm for...
That makes sense, because underground parking and parking ramps are really expensive, and roofs are generally unused places, so
yeah.
I mean, it seems like a cheap way to...
And all you have to do is reinforce the building a little bit. You have to build it a little stronger, and it can accommodate that. There's a Lowe's home improvement store in Charlotte, North Carolina, that has rooftop parking as well, and they save a ton of space on the land around it by not having to park that. So it's a good opportunity there.
Maybe if they did like green rooftop parking, then maybe the city would get behind it.
Maybe.
Or like the Target. If it's environmental, it's worse.
Well, it is environmental. You're already putting it on the roof anyway, which would be whatever lands on the roof in terms of rain is going to run off anyway, and that gets accommodated. So by not having a surface parking lot, you're being much more environmentally friendly. And
I'm just kind of joking, actually. I'm just being sarcastic.
Oh, but stop
annoying.
Joking, because this is a serious matter.
I know it's serious. But you're right. It, like, just we need to think about environmentalism. Land use is environmentalism, not just things that look like they're green.
Mm-hmm.
So I should say we've been joined by Nate Hood. Nate, welcome.
Hey, Nate. Guys, just thought I'd stop by. I'm going to sit this one out, watch the live podcast here. So I feel like I'm getting a show. So you guys continue.
Sounds good.
I kind of wanted to hear Nate and Bill as St. Paul residents just across the river. Well, you're kind of just across the river.
I'm a long way across the river.
But, like, you know, Bill, you already kind of talked about your, you know, how you perceive East Lake Street and what you, you know, see as being here. I guess talk about, you know, what do you think of it? Are there things here that would draw you here? And are there things that could be added that would make it more of a draw as, you know, people that live fairly close by?
Sure, that's a really good question. I found myself occasionally going to the Longfellow Grill because I downloaded this app that they have, and they always have these amazing deals. Like, free dessert after 9. You don't even have to buy stuff. You just show up after 9 and you can get like some cheesecake.
You seriously do that? That's almost shameful, dude.
No, I mean, I'll get a drink while I'm there, right?
Okay.
But I'll take advantage of this really good app, and I'll make like a bike ride out of it. So I'll do like an evening bike ride there along the river, and that'll be like my nightly activity. So
you burn off the cheesecake, and
exactly.
That is smart.
You know how far you have to bike to burn off a cheesecake?
I'd probably have to make a couple rounds. But so I'll go there, but usually I don't find myself over on East Lake Street. It's more kind of a pass-through area. One thing personal about me is I actually don't like driving on interstate, so if I have any option to take any type of side street, I will. So I may be to blame for some of the auto orientation that happens on Lake Street, but I'll take Lake Street if I'm going to, say, the Target on Hiawatha, as opposed to, like, go around or do any shopping like that. So I will use it as kind of a drive-through corridor. But when I look at maybe the urbanist in me, when I look at East Lake Street, I see endless potential. I see what we have here today. You've got some great nodes of some really great urbanism and some great stuff. I think all that it's going to take is just a progressive developer to come in and really turn this corridor around. When I say turn it around, it's not bad by any means. It's not like it really needs to be gentrified or anything like that. I think the area, especially along the river, is phenomenally nice. You've got some amazing places. And I think that this area is just waiting for the right businesses and the right developers to come in and really add that extra level of what I would say urbanism to the neighborhood.
I think. Go ahead.
I just wanted to know if either of you guys know what the actual zoning is.
It's
almost
hodgepodge.
All C1, C2. Yeah. It's a basic commercial zoning.
Yeah. There are some more intense zoning areas, but it's a lot of C1,
like,
C2.
The Target big box area is mixed use or not for being in a station area.
The Target big box area around the rail station, they put that as part of the pedestrian overlay district, which that's actually very vague. But one of the requirements that it cuts out of being in the pedestrian overlay district is for new commercial, they don't have to add any additional parking. So that kind of frees up anybody who would come in there.
Hypothetical people you were talking about, Sam, right? The hypothetical developer that would build that hypothetical building next to the Target parking lot.
Right. You don't need any parking there. I mean, you probably build underground parking for the residents, but you work out a deal for the retail space to just use the Target parking lot for their spaces. It's, again, a no-brainer. I think the other thing that's forbidden in the pedestrian overlay is drive-throughs, which the new McDonald's replaced the old McDonald's. They're just outside the pedestrian overlay, so they were essentially grandfathered in. And my understanding of that situation is they were grandfathered in more ways than just that. The city lacked the... I could get in trouble for this. The cojones to say, we want you McDonald's, but you gotta be in a more urban setting. Essentially, what we got was a new building, and the same kind of layout. There's still a drive-through. There's still a big parking lot. There's this little sidewalk that now connects to the corner, so if you're walking, you can take the sidewalk. But it's really not much of an improvement at all. And it's a missed opportunity.
That McDonald's is like the only substantial reinvestment in the corridor in like the last, since West River Commons.
And how sad is that, right? Well, and I think that really comes down to the zoning and the issue that I brought up in the study is the form-based code. And a McDonald's would never be allowed in that situation unless it was in the building as an inline tenant with parking behind or, hidden, with the buildings built right up to the sidewalk in a very pedestrian-friendly manner. And those McDonald's like that exist all over the country and they're happy to be there when they feel the customers...
Or when they're forced to do it, basically.
When they're forced to do it, but when they feel like... It's no different than Walgreens or other chains that realize, we're going to get plenty of pedestrian customers, and it's okay. We're ready to do this, and we're confident we can make a go of it. So Lake Street is sort of in this in between. They want to be pedestrian friendly, but they're not. It's not quite willing to accept the density required to be completely pedestrian reliant. There's sort of this in-between time where it takes a lot of willpower and the right zoning tools and investment by the city and developers to accomplish just a more urban in intense feel, and I think the density is certainly lacking right now. Like, if you put in a McDonald's with no parking, yes, it would fail. Okay. I know, I understand that, but there's also this in-between time when the parking can be hidden behind the building and can still work. And let's talk about West River Commons for a sec, because there could have been a national chain in there, maybe a Starbucks, for example, and that could work very well. And there's a chain coffee shop, a local chain, Dunn Brothers.
I just was there the other day. It's really, yeah.
And they have plenty of parking behind the building, hidden off-street, and the building facade is a combination of attractive pedestrian-friendly retailers on a little section of the site and a lot of residential walkout units on the rest of the site. And there's a couple lessons here. They didn't put too much retail in for the parking. There's enough parking behind the building and then some on street to accommodate the ratio of parking to accommodate the retail space. And there's only about 8,000 square feet of retail. And the rest is residential, which doesn't need the surface parking anywhere. It's underground. That's taken care of. If that developer decided to go all the way, to use the whole site as first floor retail, they wouldn't have enough parking. And they probably wouldn't find enough tenants to pay rates for new retail space anyway. So there'd be a problem. So Michael Lander got the amount of retail space right, but he also did the right thing by having the apartments that do face the street and are on the street level to have walkout units and pedestrian entrances. So that development overall has no surface parking visible from the street. There's a couple of driveway entrances and they're well screened, but it has about 11 or 12 pedestrian doors, combination of residential unit entrances and retail. So the streetscape is very good around that whole building, and it works well on a number of levels.
One thing too, when you inject a building like this into a traditional street grid, you always have alternatives. So if you drive through the parking lot once, and it seems like a small parking lot for the size of the building, you know, you drive through there, you just take a right and go on a side street, and as long as you know you're capable to parallel park, you're totally fine. There's no parking issue. But as long as you allow adjacent on-street parking in situations like that, I think that you're going to be fine. And I think
yes.
And I think that that's one of the, you know, anybody going to West River Commons has that alternative, the on-street alternative.
And I think in a certainly in a less pedestrian-friendly area, you know, go to Applebee's in the suburbs, and if you don't find a spot in the parking lot, it really isn't a very nice, pleasant thing to actually have to walk from.
I would argue that even if you find
a good point, you can't. In fact, when I go to West River Commons, even if I park in the parking lot behind, and I think it's a very good idea that they have a parking lot entrance to that building. Those retail spaces you can get to straight from the parking lot, and then there's a back corridor to get to all four retail spaces. That's great. Very intelligent. I walk around the front because I like it. It's so well done that it's worth my footfalls. And I'd rather walk a little farther to get to the front door because it's done well. And I think I'm a total freak of nature for that, but and probably the exclusion to the rule. And my wife thinks I'm crazy. But
I don't think
you know
you're
what?
Freak of nature.
Well, at this table, we're all on the same page, probably, but...
No, not me. Actually, I'm out on this one.
Okay. You want the convenience? Yeah.
No.
But, I mean, that is a lesson. Is when you're designing mixed use, you can't assume that everybody's arriving on foot anyway, and it's you should have those two doors. It does make sense.
That's a very good point. There's a development. It's fairly new. It's in St. Louis Park, Minneapolis border on Excelsior and France. It's on the very northwest corner. And there's this nice restaurant there. It's called, like, the Mill Valley Kitchen. It's, like, all local, all organic, nice restaurant. It's in a mixed-use building, but the main front door that faces the intersection of France and Excelsior Well, you can't get in there. You've got to walk all the way around to the back and enter through the back.
So it's a fake door? It's like the fake windows that I get frustrated by?
It's a fake window slash door, and there's a door that just says, use the back door. And it would be so simple to just have a little entrance there and then have a little table and a little pathway that goes through, and you know, it wouldn't force people who walk there, because some parts of St. Louis Park there are actually pretty walkable, and you're basically just giving the middle finger to anybody who decides to walk there, and then you say walk through the parking lot where they coincidentally have no sidewalks there. So you just gotta walk through the middle of the parking lot. So
that's probably a... you get at a good point, Nate, because that's a business decision. That's them saying, we have one door at one end of our restaurant and one at the other, and we only want one open. And it happens all the time when you have urban...
What's the logic if you're a business owner?
Security, and you don't want to have people walk all the way through your store. No matter what kind of store you are, you know, the cash registers are at one end, or the host is at one end. They're, you know, to make people walk all the way through doesn't make sense. West River Common, you know, the Longfellow Grill works because the parking corridor and the pedestrian door wind up at the same spot. You wind up at the host booth, so you're right there, and you know that a lot of thought went into that design, I'm sure. And with Dunn Brothers, they're at opposite ends of the store. The gift shop and the take and bake pizza are at the opposite ends of the store. But it may very well be that, I'm just guessing here, that the developer, you know, the landlord, Michael Lander, in his eternal wisdom, said, hey, look, if you're going to sign a lease here, you're going to have both doors open at all hours. You can't shut one of them and say, go around to the other side. That may very well be in their lease, and I'm guessing it is, because I think in a lot of, when you have an urbanized suburban location where you have the main street, you know, like in Maple Grove where you got the main street, but there's a ton of parking behind those stores, the main entrances really are the back. And often the front door is shut and locked, and that doesn't do anything for anybody. And I'd rather have the parking be in front and have the building be set back and have the front door be honest than have it be fake. It really, it's a touchy situation. It relies on some on-street parking. I mean, the business has to know that some of their customers are coming from the front door and need that front door.
So here's a question, Sam. So pretend I'm a venture capitalist and I've got $5 million to burn, and you're a developer, and I trust you, I like you, you're a good guy. Here's $5 million. You need to build something in this section of East Lake Street. What do you do? What's your action plan? You don't have to build anything, but what's your action plan?
He has to build something.
I would want a return on my, you know, $5 million.
I would. My concept would be, honestly, I would do an all residential building or a mixed use with some limited retail on the main floor. But I'd start with, I'd probably have two scenarios, and I'd start with, what does the building look like at the sidewalk? How many windows and pedestrian entrances are there? And regardless if they're residential or retail, how does it look if you're standing on the sidewalk in front of the building? And I'd choose a site that didn't have good existing urbanism. I'd find a building that was vacant and was already not adding to the retail, to the pedestrian experience of the street. So I'd start with principles and then build hopefully an honest money-making venture from there. But that's partly because I believe that long-term there's a lot of value in doing the right thing. And often that gets mistaken for the short-term value of doing the wrong thing, which can make you a lot of money. So, you know, the reality is there's a lot of moving parts, and I'd I'd go into it very carefully, but with high ideals and hopes that it can work out, and that the neighborhood would go along with it. That's often and this isn't meant to pick on Longfellow in any case, because everywhere you go when you try to do development where there's uncertainty, the uncertainty often comes in with a neighborhood group. And it can be one person who opposes a project and gets a bunch of people on their side, and then your project's toast. It doesn't matter how much support you have from the bank and a great design from the architect and even city support. If the city council member realizes it, you know, it's not going to do well politically, they oppose it, and it's just an unfortunate situation. So I'd also try to vet it with the neighborhood first. And
that's really hard. It's funny that you bring up West River Commons as an example so often, because that's the example that I've heard, I think, from you guys or someone about a project that was fought, you know, tooth and nail. Is that a phrase, tooth and nail?
That is.
When it was proposed, and then once it was built, turned out to be a huge success, and everyone likes it. And it's,
well, it's why Michael Lander is now, he's fought a couple of these battles, and he really doesn't want to have to do it again. So he hasn't built a big project since, more or less. And he, although he tried once, and he, out by Lake Calhoun, and that got shot down. So he is sticking to smaller scale stuff for now. Who knows what, you know? The point is, the shame of all this is we're one of our better developers, more creative, with some of the best product the city has seen in the last decade. We're making his life hell, and we need to be attracting people like that. And I think the public process and its interplay with the zoning and the visioning process is that's what the problem is here. And if we have a very good, well-vetted vision and plan that's supported by the city but bought into by the neighbors, that you can come back and say, yeah, we said this, and this is the way we want the street to look, development along it, that goes a long way in the political process when an actual development scenario comes along, like a Michael Lander, or even some hack can come in and say, well, I want to do this, but I can't because you guys want something good. So I have to do something good. Okay, at least the pieces are in place. And so, any discussion of a form-based code has to be rooted in a strong vision for what that corridor or area should look like. And the two are integrally intertwined. And then you get that certainty from the development and the private side where they say, okay, this is what you want. I'll design and build that for you for the most part. And then you get good results.
So Sam, you recently did a study. I think I missed this part of the conversation.
Yes.
When you presented that to the neighborhood group or to the local councils or whomever, what was the reception? What was the feedback that you got immediately?
Crickets chirping. No. It was. I had to be very careful.
If somebody asked this question, I apologize.
No one did. This is good.
Anyone listening, I missed about the first 25, 30 minutes of this thing.
Actually, I think this is the most important part of suggesting what I was presenting, was how is it going to go over in a room full of residents? I can talk to planners all day about what's right, and they'll say, yeah, that'd be great if we could do a form-based code. What's good development? Okay, great. But when residents, I tried to instill in them a sense of hope and the idea that they can affect change, and that really to get attention to this part of the street, they have to go to City Hall and say, hey, this is a really important corridor for the city, and we need help here, and we want to do the right thing. So I was trying to suggest positives while conveying a sense that it's not easy. Coming up with a vision that the city and the, there was a planning document for 36th to the river 10 or 12 years ago that never has been officially bought into by the city. So it sits there, and some of the things they talked about have actually happened, but not because of any city hall buy-in or official implementation or changes to the code or anything. So I think it's important that that the neighbors and the residents and business owners can think that, yeah, there is a good future for this area, but it takes a lot of work, and you do have to get the city hall and the political process involved and to make genuine change. So, you know, there's a lot of moving parts here, but again, when I presented initially, I didn't want to just spit out a bunch of numbers and say, yeah, the retail market will take care of this. I had to say, no, that's actually, what do you want to see? And it won't come out exactly the way you want, but if you need to at least express what you want the corridor to look like 20 years, 30 years from now, and start with that. And my understanding is there's been meetings that have been ongoing about what to do next, and you know, I think that's an ongoing process.
There's a lot of interest, and the study definitely stimulated a lot of interest. I think people have, you know, their ideas of businesses they like to see, and it's generally kind of like higher end retail, higher end, you know,
up Trader Joe's. Middle,
yeah, Trader Joe's, that's the one.
People love Trader Joe's.
I've heard martini bars, I've heard pet grooming, you know, places. But, you know, so there's interest, but it's still kind of basic question, what, you know, as a neighborhood resident, what can you do to actually help bring those types of businesses to the corridor? You know, is it by encouraging a comprehensive or a small area plan being done for the corridor? Is it encouraging the zoning to be changed? Is it even just contacting businesses and telling them,
I think that's part of it.
Here's a vacant spot. You should think about it. You know,
I think there's a lot of when you look at the neighborhood forums, which are a pretty good place to kind of take the pulse of what people want. When you can kind of get past the complaining side of it and say, yeah, people want this, and they want this, and they... People need to know when a good thing is happening to them and embrace it. And the Blue Door Pub is a good example of the immediate...
Of a place you can't get a beer outside. That's a good example of a place you can't get a beer outside.
That's St. Paul City regulation, though. So.
But the new one is going in here in Longfellow.
Oh,
and
kidding.
Yeah, and it was...
I bet you can get a beer outside there. That'll be a great comparison test.
Probably not.
You can't.
What? No.
You
no. Lo and behold, the immediate neighbors were concerned. And, you know, okay, if you buy a house that's two doors down from a proposed bar, you might get worried. I understand that. But you also bought a house two doors down from a commercially zoned property. You know, we can't control what the market's going to be. And, you know, in my neighborhood, the Northbound Smokehouse Brew Pub is brand new. It opened a couple weeks ago. It used to be a furniture store that had, it was a great store. It had very little traffic, and it didn't bother anybody. And now there's going to be all these people coming day and night, and, you know, they're going to be parking on your lawn. And throwing up on your back sidewalk. I mean, like, there's this concern that they're going to be smashing bottles on your porch. There's this concern that it's going to ruin the neighborhood. But you know what? On the one hand, you bought a house near commercially zoned property. You can't control what the private market does. That's part of the beauty of
capitalism
and America. Yeah.
Sam, you mentioned Smokehouse. That's also that's in Standish. It's on 38th Street and like 28th Avenue. That's an interesting model of neighbors investing in a business startup that they want to see in their neighborhood. Then they do either a Kickstarter or some sort of.
Yeah, actually, there was very little opposition. Uh-huh. You know, the next door neighbor was probably concerned that of the noise and stuff, but really there wasn't much pushback. But 30 or 40 people invested money that provided cash for them to get their loan to even open the business. So
and
we, in return, you got free beer for life or an actual percentage ownership of the business.
Did you donate money?
I donated money to the free beer side. And but those that donated 5,000 or more got both. Free beer and a percentage of. So if the place is profitable, they get a little check every quarter or whatever. And they're a silent partner, you know, they can't decide what's on the menu and all that. But it created a couple things, and it's really early. But Mill Haven's very good. I don't think we. It's probably another table, but
I thought that free beer for life ticket was.
It's good here too. Yeah. Wow, I thought it was only good at the northbound. But it created a couple things. There's a definite sense that there are local people who believe in this and wanted it, and now they get to go enjoy it and talk to each other, and there's this community building aspect of it. It also provided a lot of cash for the business to move ahead, and that's awesome.
I mean, I don't know if you know this, were they unable to get traditional means of financing?
Yes.
Because there's,
well,
did they perceive it as too much risk?
Yes, because they had an investor that had to bail because of the stock market, so it was really a one-off situation where they're like, oh, we're out $150,000. So let's find a way to fill that gap. And they actually made $200,000 in 3 weeks and filled the gap. And then the bank was upset because they publicized it. Well, how the hell do you tell people you need money without asking for money? So, you know, I think banks are usually used to, it was kind of a curveball for them because banks are used to, like, yeah, some rich person has a lot of money. They're like, this is a good idea. It's going to work. And here's our business plan. And here's my money. But here's, you know, money from 40 different people at $1,000 a piece. And it adds up. But the bank was surprised by it. But I think the value overall is it's a community gathering space double, you know, squared times 10. Because we invested our money in it. I don't care about the beer. I want a building a block from my house to be occupied by a vibrant business that attracts people and reduces crime. I think it has achieved that. We'll see. But
the beer obviously helps.
I guess my question, though, is like about what is the big problem with East Lake Street? You probably can answer this, too, is if you talk to people who live around here, right, and you say, well, what is the biggest thing that is not right about this neighborhood? What do they say? Like,
with East Lake Street?
Yeah, do they see the street and say, oh, it's fine, and it's quiet, and I like it, it's okay?
No.
Or do they look at it and say, oh, there's a big... Yeah, I'll have one more.
I think it's, generally a dissatisfaction with the amount of vacancy and just the quality of the built environment. It's hard to, do a broad brush opinion for what everyone in the neighborhood thinks, but I think there's the most common thing is just a general dissatisfaction with the number and type of businesses that are here. People would like more retail and restaurants that they can patronize locally, but there's just not a lot.
On the way over here, I called up my friend who lives a block away, and he was telling me, he said a few things. He said he'd really like to have a sports bar that he can go to because Merlin's Rest doesn't have any TVs and the Yankees-Orioles game is on right now. And he'd like to watch that. And there just really aren't... There's like a couple kind of high-end bars like the Craftsman, this place. And then there's nothing, really. Longfellow Grill has one tiny, tiny TV.
Well, and there's... That's a fickle thing about the private market is there's not demand for every corner to have a Craftsman or a Merlin's Rest or a sports bar.
Yeah, just something.
So everyone wants something, and you need the critical mass, but really you need... I mean, you know, what a lot of restaurants prove is it's the market is there as long as there's not too much competition, and if you build the right thing, people show up. And if you build... I don't think sports bars are going to just take off in Longfellow. But the Craftsman has done well, and it's been around a while. And when I did I was part of the West River Commons market study back in 2001, and one of our conclusions was a well-run sit-down restaurant with a liquor license will probably do well in this neighborhood. And it was based on demographics and spending power and the fact that there's no competition. And sure enough, the Longfellow Grill has thrived. And the Blue Plate company has about 5 restaurants now, and they're probably going to grow. I mean, it's kind of a no-brainer. But this Irish pub, Merlin's Rest, had 2 different locations before called Molly Quinn's. One was
across the street here.
Yeah, one was
Molly Quinn's. No, it's a long story. You guys don't know this whole
one
story.
One was in the Craftsman for a while, the location of the Craftsman, and they failed because they didn't have a big enough kitchen. And then they went to the old Embers on 33rd.
Sounds right, yeah.
That was an Ethiopian restaurant for a while, and then Molly Quinn's, and now it's been vacant since, and still doesn't have.
That's not the way I heard the Molly Quinn story.
What's the backstory?
It was a thriving local pub restaurant, right? And then Super America, like, somehow got this right to that their building, and like they sold the building to Super America to expand. It's the one that's about 8 blocks that way.
Yeah, it's next to Super America.
And at that point, they moved into the Ethiopian place.
That could be.
Yeah, and so I know someone else that lived around here, and she was. I think when Molly Quinn's got bought by Super America and Super America tore it down to expand, that was just this big loss for the neighborhood. Is the way that she told me the story. It had been this kind of like neighborhood pub center in the area. But the thing I want to say though is this kind of symbolizes like the auto kind of quality of this street. Like this street was the car street, like you're saying, a place you went to buy a car. And you can still feel that when you walk down and look around, and there's still like the auto zone and the Midas Muffler and like just a bunch of used car places and like that's just a lot of the street is this kind of parking lot.
You gotta ask the question. Most of the people who live in the 3-mile area around here have a car, and it needs auto parts and it needs service. And maybe they didn't buy it on Lake Street, but you know the Midas and the car repair shops presumably are doing well. In fact, those have the lowest vacancy of anything. So there is an aspect of where else are you going to go to get that, you know, headlight bulb that you need or to get your muffler fixed? Well, you come to Lake Street, and you know, in a perfect world, you'd be able to somehow concentrate all of them in like a 2-block area, and it'd be the auto mall where you could buy, fix, and get parts for your car at a bunch of different stores, and it'd be a free market thing. But nowhere else on the street would be burdened by auto dominance. You know,
you're right, but I also think that there's this aspect of some of the auto-oriented businesses here where, frankly, the buildings that they put up are shit. Sorry to give this a
expletive podcast.
But there's a beautiful example on the corner of St. Clair and Snelling Avenue, right by McAllister in St. Paul, right next to this. I guess it's like a famous dance hall, like the St. Clair Ballroom. There's this building next to it. It's this 2-story brick building. It's got a beautiful drive-in. It's a magnificent building. And now it's like a barbershop manufacturer.
Oh, yeah, William Marvey.
Yeah, but like that building supposedly was initially built as like a auto shop. Oh, yeah, right here.
Nice.
It was initially built supposedly as an auto shop, and it's this gorgeous building with this beautiful drive-in, and it comes up to the street. They've got these great pillars. It looks spectacular. So I think that, you know, well, the over-concentration of these, like, your Napa Auto Parts stores, your O'Reilly's, what have you. I think that part of it is that their buildings and the way that they are arranged on the landscape are terrible. Whereas you can have these auto shops and they can fit into a neighborhood and they can look okay. They can look totally fine. I don't know if that's going to happen under current market conditions, but like it is doable.
I think watching the Walgreens in Highland get built. There's a new Walgreens it's parked on the side. There's surface parking, but it's along Ford Parkway. It's not really on the corner, and there is a corner site that'll become a restaurant. I think gas stations and pharmacies, if they require any surface parking at all, need to be in a mid-block location. And I think zoning could help make that happen. And you know, in a perfect world, the worst thing you can do with a corner and a gas station is what happened at 28th and Lindale, where you have the building at the corner, but it faces away from the street where the gas pumps are. So there's no entrance at the corner or on the street. And I think that's...
Is that the Loon gas station? Is that the one?
No, that's a... It's a new... You know, it's a Marathon or it's a...
I think I know.
I don't remember what it is, but it's pretty new, and it was... It was built, you know, with new zoning ideals in mind, with put the building on the corner. Well, that's bullshit. If the building doesn't add any life to the corner, it shouldn't be on the corner. And so there's this tension of, yes, we need some auto uses in a... If we're not going to be a really dense, hyper-urban city, which we probably won't become, we need these trade-offs. And how do you accomplish that? I say if there's a, you know... And it's a good debate to have. There's no really right answer. But I hate it when a corner gets killed by a blank building where the entrances are on the back side. And there's a lot of different uses that do this, and over time the city has screwed up multiple times. And of course other cities have done the same thing. But don't just assume that zero setback means good urbanism, because it often means the opposite. So, and everyone needs to buy gas, because, you know, gas stations gravitate to the corner just like Walgreens do, because they have a lot of money and they can buy the best sites in cities. And those are corner sites.
Bill, you Carlos? How do you... Can I just ask, how do you get here?
Damn it. When do you get your gas? I dropped my mom off the airport. She gave me her car. Just for today, though. It's only one day only.
I was just curious, you know.
Normally, I bike down.
You look to car sit a lot? Is that what you do?
It's just a random coincidence. Okay. But normally, actually, the only way... East Lake Street is a very popular corridor for bicyclists. Or if you're taking the bus, it's really easy to do. So.
I think that to create good urban retail, I think that the demographics are here. Seward is just north of here, and I think that's a very cool neighborhood. Like, a lot is going on in Seward. A lot of great stuff is going on in Seward. And south of here, I mean, you've got Longfellow, and Longfellow, at least, you know, from people who I know who I graduated with, Longfellow is the cool neighborhood. Like, that's where it's where everybody who's... They're sick of uptown in the wedge, and they want to buy a house, yes. So then they buy it. So then they go
it's
to
popular Longfellow. With first-time home
yeah,
buyers.
First-time home yeah, first-time homebuyers, for sure.
Everybody that I know...
A lot of young people.
Not everybody, but young people, like, you know, approaching their 30s, they're buying in Longfellow. And I think that they're really... You know, with this stretch of East Lake Street, I think that there's a huge pent-up demand for really great, kind of cool urban retail to happen on Lake Street. I think that the market's there.
And I think if you're lucky enough to live within a couple blocks, you can walk to it, but the reality is you have to provide parking, and that's acceptable. And that's the other challenge with Lake Street is it's a narrow corridor. And when you look at it, there's single-family homes that start within 60 to 80 feet on either side of it. They're right there, and it's very unpopular to create a plan and a vision that says, we're going to take out a half block or a block of homes or even one home. These single-family homes are very sacred in planning in most cities, and so... You know, you may have that first home say, yeah, I'm ready to sell, and you can build your grocery store and parking lot. I don't care what you do. I don't want to be here anyway. I'm old. I'm done owning a home. But, you know, that's a decision that homeowner has to make. But in the planning process, to suggest taking out single-family homes is like, it's like eminent domain, but it's, even when it's not, it feels like the government is taking over, and that's not good. Somehow commercial property is always okay, but single-family homes are sacred, and that's the challenge is what can you do with 60 to 100-foot wide deep lots that, you know, yes, you can build small apartment buildings or small retail buildings, and you have to find the parking somewhere, but it's not, you know, a lot of redevelopment that has happened is these nice big sites that are a big 4-acre square chunk. You don't have to worry about alleys. You don't have to worry about homes or anything. It's just there. And, yeah, it does make it easier. But
I've always wondered this with Minneapolis. What's going to happen when we've run out of old industrial space to redevelop? It will have to, like, migrate to the neighborhoods, right? Will the attitudes have changed by then, or what will we do?
Well, the attitudes change when you get the value of your home. When you get an offer for your house for what you think it's worth, your attitude changes. You go, oh, well, okay. You know, it's one thing to say, these planners and developers are going to ruin my neighborhood. But when they make an offer on your house and you think, wow, $200,000? I thought my house was only worth $190,000. Sure, I'm willing to sell. Yeah, it happened.
Hello.
It happened near me.
And you want to interrupt?
No, well, we're in the middle of the podcast.
For informational purposes, Sam's family just showed up.
My family just showed up.
And they're very adorable.
And
well, should we wrap it up?
They're eating their fries.
This might be a good time.
But are there any conclusions we can draw? I mean, if there's one thing that we can do to help East Lake Street right now, what would it be? Where's the missing link right now?
Nah. The missing link is, I don't know, as generic as it sounds, it's an overriding vision for the corridor and a code that it can actually produce that vision over time, meaning probably a form-based code.
I would say open a business on East Lake Street. I think one of the coolest things to happen in the last 6 months is Forage Modern Workshop.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
Yes.
They remodeled an old, it was used by a carpenter's union, just a one-story commercial building, previously no active storefront, but they remodeled it, added some windows, made it into a really cool space, and they're, you know, a really unique business that, you know, it's unique to the city.
What do they sell?
Really just cool furniture and home furnishings. I think they have a lot of Ralph Rapson inspired stuff. And they're actually...
There is something modernist about East Lake Street.
Yeah, kind of.
That leather supply place or whatever, that sign that they have.
And they're using they have a space in the building that they're turning into a cafe. They're partnering with Dogwood Coffee, Rustica Bakery, two awesome businesses.
Wow, yeah.
And that, they'll have a
beer
license.
Dogwood and Rustica.
And a Victory 44 restaurant in North Minneapolis. They have a great chef there. Yeah, that'll be opening up.
There's plenty of, like, super high-end stuff on East Lake, but there's not much in the middle. Right? You can either get, like, a dollar store or, like, a really, really expensive place. You know what I mean? And there's just not the density for anything in between, seems to me.
Yeah, I think in the short term, it's, you know, I think Sam made some good points about what needs to happen that'll kind of help improve the corridor over the long term. But over the short term, I'm just really excited about some additional businesses coming in. And I think that grocery store proposed at 39th would be the single biggest thing that could help kind of revitalize this part of the corridor.
Yeah, that could actually catalyze quite a bit, since there's a big vacant former SA kitty corner across the street, and, you know, there's a lot of potential. You know, and with all the small businesses that have come into the city in different places, there is a lot of upside along the street if people, you know, if those business owners decide Lake Street's worth investing in. It is, absolutely.
Yeah, so. I think so, too. I think we can all agree on that, huh?
Uh-huh.
All right, well, on that note, let's wrap it up. Let's say thanks for listening, and
thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. If you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn on Twitter @StreetsMN or email me at blindicky@gmail.com. So long from Eastlake.